We are going to get going. We have a full day again today, the second day of Sound Vision Action. Exciting to be here. Thank you for making it early on Saturday morning on what seems to me to be a cold day, or Montrealers are saying it's a beautiful day. We have a couple of quick housekeeping things. If you're trying to get Wi-Fi, you were not here yesterday. The network is called Evenmore, as in events. The password is wonderfully complicated. I will read it, and then I will leave it out in the front. It's, are you ready? Capital P, Z, or Z, depending on which side of the frontier you're from. 42FZ, or Z, 7T. So only the first P is a capital, everything else is lowercase. PZ, 42FZ, 7T. So that... Have good eyesight. Hopefully, you can read that. So we have a couple of housekeeping announcements. I hope people have already noticed, but unfortunately, due to illness, Georgina Bourne won't be able to be here with us today. But that gives us a chance to look a little more of Natalie Bookchin's film, which is going to be, so that's going to be a great bonus for us. And the discussion session will be inspired by Don's presentation yesterday. We're going to do that as a kind of small groups feedback kind of thing, so that everybody will have a chance to participate and let us all know what you thought. So, without further ado, this morning's session has a rather generic title of Humanity, but we have two excellent presentations that I think are going to knock us into a really interesting place. I'm going to take a minimum amount of time here to introduce, because there are very full and beautiful introductions to both speakers in your booklet that you have in your folder. And I want just to try and give as much time for the discussion as possible. So first up is Negar Motadé, who is at Duke University, and she is there a cultural and film theorist specializing in interdisciplinary and feminist contributions to Middle Eastern and film studies. And she has a great book called Displaced Allegories, Iranian Post-Revolutionary Cinema. She has a really exciting book coming out on Twitter and the Iranian Revolution. So, Negar, I'm going to turn it over to you. I will introduce Annette before she does her presentation.
Thank you, Nick. We weren't going to do that, right? That introduction. But thank you so much. Very sweet. I feel so lucky to be here with all of you. And I want to thank Jonathan and Nick for bringing us all together. I'm learning so much from you. And thank you, Tamar, for everything, including pinning me in this morning. this project on light has, it has evolved into a project on Iran and cinema in a historical way and elemental way. It deals with three, one could say, elements: with light, with wind, and with oil in cinema. And it corresponds to three different periods in Iranian history. One is the post-revolutionary period, which has to do with Islam. So the light section is really on that period. The section on wind is about is connected with the history of Iran and slavery, where the wind was said to affect the slaves who were coming from Africa to Iran and to possess them. So this is that section is about possession in film, and an example of that would be in a very popular Iranian film called Bashu. The other section is on oil, which is in the is the middle history between these two periods, and it's on the British oil industry's production of films, on Iranian modernization. So how oil, their search, their quest for oil in Iran, modernized Iran, created a modern Iran. And this became a very popular format in documentary filmmaking in Iran from the 1950s through the 70s. So, One Light, Cinema and Islamic Spirituality. Luminous and present, recorded and mediated, light's impact may be considered foundational. In the context of Islam, its impression on the human sensorium is said to affect the very essence of that which is human, the human soul. Sayyid Hossein Nass writes regarding our relation to light that the soul of the Muslim, and in fact the primal man in every man, yearns for the light, which is ultimately the symbol of divine presence. To this, one Sufi commentator adds regarding the sensorial body and soul that access to that which our soul becomes knowing begins by way of the senses. So long as we do not perceive sensible things, the visible, the audible, the sapid, the odorous, and the tangible, knowledge is out of our reach. In sum, it is the human sensorium, awash in light, that facilitates the believer's presence to the knowledge of divine light. Cinema's impact on the senses as a mediator of the luminous presence of the divine in its play of light must be considered vital to any discussion of Islamic spirituality. These first principles on light, the soul and the senses, stand at the threshold of my considerations of cinema and spirituality. We find the key to the intimacies of this human yearning for light and to cinema's engagement with it in an anecdotal scene in the 1995 Iranian film Pari, directed by Dariush Mehrjooi. Pari is loosely based on J.D. Salinger's Fanny and Zoe. The plot follows the restless college student and one-time stage actress Pari, a young intellectual who rebels against the superficiality and egocentrism of the culture around her. Constantly escaping her family and associates, she buries herself in the words and ceaseless prayers recorded in a mystical text, Soluk, a book she has been carrying around with her for some time. As the narrative of her rebellion unfolds within the film, we meet her fiancé and her three brothers, the eldest of whom we come to learn has died in a fire that he has set on his own home. The anecdotal moment I would like to consider occurs in a scene about midway through the film. Here, in a flashback focused on the memory of Pari's elder brother, the film dwells on a tender exchange with Pari's brother, in which Pari's brother tells a little neighbor girl about the strange existence of sunfish. Sunfish, he says, are a school of tiny fish that are so in love with the light that if they catch a glimmer of it on the surface of the water at night, they spring out onto the riverbank in their desire to find its source. Once ashore, he tells her, they wither and die. We're reminded of this story late in the film in a scene in which Paddy's other brother, this one, goes to look for Paddy in the burned-down home of their dead brother at night. As he walks on the riverbank towards the scorched remains of his brother's home, the young man shines his flashlight carelessly on the surface of the water. Drawn to the light, scores of sunfish spring out of the water and fall wriggling on the snow before his feet. Observing the sunfish's uninhibited love for light, Paddy's brother comes to recognize the source of Paddy's spiritual quest. Hers is a yearning. And devotion that is not unlike the one he witnesses in the brief life of the sunfish. So although he has been strongly opposed to Paddy's spiritual quest, earlier in the film, he finds himself embracing her gesture of ceaseless prayer as her soul's meditative immersion in the wonder of life and in the magical beauty that is everywhere, regardless of its source. From this perspective, he concludes, the light of the stage, which she has abandoned, is as divine in origin as those shafts of light that immerse her believing body in the light of God as she turns her soul to prayer at the mosque. It is back towards the stage light that he directs her devotion to the divine. In my reading of Pari, this reflective moment of exchange between brother and sister is critical in that it is also an instance of reflexivity in the film. In the equation between the light of the stage and the light of the mosque, the film self-reflexively shows itself as not singular in the craft of placing the physical body in the presence of light. Sacred architecture, the mosque, has served a similar function. The exchange between the brother and sister in Paddy's final scene, then, draws our attention to the mosque and shows the manner in which sacred architecture enfolds the body in light, just as film does. To draw parallels between the two art forms that affect the senses by their use of light is not to suggest an identity between them. Cinema and architecture are undoubtedly different in practice and purpose. While one is fully physically inhabited, the other is visually and orally so. One is temporal in its expression of movement from frame to frame, the other spatial, a spatial experience through and through. One assumes a quattrocento framing, a framing of the narrative that places the viewer as the focal point of shots and scenes. The other produces a parallax effect that results in a shift in the appearance of the built environment as the body moves through it, a perception of material space that Le Corbusier termed the promenade architecturale. The primary difference between film and architecture lies in cinema's temporal base, however. True, certain architectural forms may articulate particular temporalities by aligning built form, light, and environmental conditions, but it is when cinema can say something about the timeless presence that arrests its passage, and when architecture can say something about the transient moment which unsettles its permanence, it's then that the extraordinary and the uncanny are enabled to take place and come to pass. This experience of the uncanny occurs in the spatio-temporal instance of our sensorial encounter with the symbolics of light in cinema and in architecture both. This, as I will attempt to show, is the oratic moment of connectivity between the perceiving subject and a material object. Sayyid Hossein Nasr observes that the great masterpieces of architecture, such as the Alhambra, the Iwans, and the courtyard of so many of the Persian mosques and the Taj Mahal, are like crystallizations of light. Limpid, lucid, illuminating, and illuminated, these sites of sacred experience in Islamic architecture are perceived by our senses as sacred precisely because they are defined by the vibrations of light. The breathtaking solasticies of the court of Lyon in Alhambra do not impress themselves on us in their practical function, which is to support the roof, for example. Instead, they symbolize the descent of light into the world of material form. This symbolic encounter with the material form in sacred architecture impacts our senses in an experience of awe, opening our senses to the beauty and possibility of another world, a sacred universe besides and integral to the material world. In my understanding, it is the sensorial perception of this metamorphosis, something akin to a temporal experience of material space, that affects and transforms our entire being. In this moment of alchemical transformation of stone to light, architecture becomes the middle ground, a liminal space that mediates between humans and that which they seek, fear, or worship. An early scene is illustrative. In the film, Paddy is illustrative. Paddy is in her parental home in Tehran, and she is restless, frustrated with the clutter and noise of the ongoing repairs in the old home. Paddy leaves Tehran to visit her fiancé, who is studying in Isfahan, and after stopping at the Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque for prayers, the two of them sit at a restaurant to have lunch. She gets frustrated with the conversation, excuses herself from the table, her fiancé lights a cigarette, and the camera follows Paddy as she rushes off towards the bathroom upstairs. Finding the bathroom occupied, Paddy waits ponderously by the window and looks over Isfahan's rooftops and a distant mosque. We find in this In this scene by the window, another reflexive moment in Petty, one that again draws equivalences between film and architecture. The scene is made up of a point of view shot sequence from Petty's perspective and culminates in a shot reverse shot in which her look at the mosque is returned by a light that blinds her. Petty looks into the light, and as she does, she sees the sage author of the book that she has been studying come running towards her. The brilliance of the light that returns her look at the mosque is so strong that Petty faints, and in a dream state, she bears witness to the sage's recital of the full text of the Quran from a well in the caravanserai.
چی بشه؟ یه چیزی، یه نوری تو قلبت پیدا میشه که بتونی باش خدا رو ببینی. ببخشی
Read in light of Walter Benjamin's early writings, this scene describes a quintessential uncanny experience akin to one of nature opening its eyes. For Benjamin, this is an auratic moment in which the subject invests the material world with the capability of returning the gaze. In our example, standing by the window, Patty looks at the mosque. Her look is returned by the mosque, releasing the light that is importantly animated by the body of her sage. This auratic scene within the narrative represents a moment of transference, a metaphoric activity which goes beyond establishing a communicative exchange with the natural environment that surrounds her and invests things, including in this case the built environment, with the magical qualities of nature itself. Such investments turn architecture into a city, indeed a city, into a mnemotechnic device, allowing one to unearth in literal objects of a metaphoric meaning that at once is habitual, disjunctive, intersecting past and future, history and myth, loss and desire, indeed recollection and collective unconscious. In Benjamin's description of aura, the gaze that returns our look on the object does not, in fact, mirror us in our present conscious identity, but assumes a transformed identity, in effect, another self never seen before in a waking state. The look is returned, but another dreaming other receives it. Paris' narrative look to the mosque is auratically returned by it. The light emanating from it affects the seer and the seen. At the same time, it displaces the seer with another receiving self. Another scene makes this transformation of the receiver even more explicit. When Patty disappears in the Sheikh Lotfullah Mosque after her arrival to Isfahan, she's affected by the light of the mosque and transformed by it. The light, by the light of the mosque and transformed by it, the film shows that in returning her gaze, the radiant light from the dome of the mosque transports her whole being to a time and space elsewhere. The film shows Patty scaling a tower and looking at the mosque from a distance, all the while her physical self stands motionless in devotion under the luminous dome where her fiancé finds her. Effectively, here, it is another Patty that her fiancé finds there. This auratic sense of being received into a presence, which is precisely how the architect Arthur Pope describes the experience of this specific mosque in Isfahan, is represented in the film by the dance of luminous shards that engulf Patty's body in devotion. Here, the filmic mise-en-scene signals an experience in space that is temporalized. It signals this by generating an experience of temporality in the narrative that is spatialized. This unsettling experience is the experience of aura itself, evidencing an atomicity that cuts through time, one in which the here and now of the present is experienced as another time, present to other future pasts. The artist and film theorist Jalal Tawfiq describes as atomism a view of reality where what seems to be one entity subsisting in linear time is actually a myriad such entities recurring in multiple times, reinforcing one's feeling of a link between this spatial repetition and the temporal recreation that passes normally unperceived. Atomism is an understanding of time of which Islam is at least spiritually cognizant. In the Sufi understanding, for example, the universe is being created at every moment. At every moment, what appears to be a time-connected universe returns to God. There is continuous instantaneous expansion and contraction. At every moment, creation is annihilated and recreated. With every heartbeat, we die and are reborn. The creative pattern of continuous appearance and disappearance in the divine order is in fact structurally akin to the formal mechanisms of representation in cinema, where what we perceive as the constant and present narrative image is a process that is generative of continuous displacements. Here, as witness to the emanations of divine light, Patty is both there and elsewhere. Her displacement, as witness within the cinematic form, alerts the viewer reflexively of his own displacement in the temporal play of creation and annihilation that is his own spiritual universe. The sensory effect of arabesque as detail in sacred architecture and illumination is experienced in similar ways. A sense of recognition occurs to me in front of an arabesque, one that lasts an instant, but to be seamlessly replaced by another sense of recognition in the next instant. For the person in front of the arabesque is herself a temporal arabesque, myriad extremely similar but non-identical versions of herself. The self whose look has been returned is not the self who looked, but another, simultaneously a transcription and an echo, the first seamlessly displaced by another. As witness to a witness in Patty, the viewer is inscribed by the film with this sense experience atomistically. This occurs from the instant that Patty enters the mosque in Isfahan. From that moment on, it is as if the look that returns Patty's look at the mosque transforms the spaces in which she moves, drawing light, the light of another world, onto the this-worldly plane. All space loses its profane quality and is bathed instead in the sacred light that first finds its source in the palpable light of the mosque. Time, too, loses its hold on the narrative. Both on and off-screen spaces are reflexively engulfed in this light, in the light of the One. Le Corbusier's dictum that architecture is the masterly and correct and magnificent play of masses brought together in light thus endures. The film mobilizes light in this way to support its own ultimate thesis that all spaces, stage and mosque, film and architecture, are suitably supportive of the soul's existential yearning for divine nearness. The auratic experience in Patty, its submission of all things to the ecstasies of divine light, formulates an atomism that reflexively renders animate the multiple temporalities of the conscious viewing subject, as if he or she were standing before the mirror of the arabesque at the mosque. As witness to the annihilation of self and the birth of the self as another in a new moment of possibility. Such an understanding of the mimetic and auratic potential of film suggests a fundamental reconsideration of the traditionally argued prohibition against the representation of animate forms in Islam. For as we have seen, cinema's mimetic powers enable a spiritual awakening to the mystical play of absence and presence in the auratic universe. These precise conjunctions signal the second mimetic function of film technologies that take film beyond the primary indexical function of as technologies of realism, of mirroring and representation, to behave reflexively and instrumentally as the senses of a largely unconscious collective before the screen. Integral to our mimetic faculty as viewers, film technologies provide us with the capacity to see collectively and to see otherwise in effect, to see as another. Catching fleeting glimpses of unconscious correspondences, they enable us to see the play of disillusion and reconstitution in what we otherwise perceive as permanent and real. Thus, film technologies act as an optical unconscious, reflexively drawing attention to what our eyes see without actually observing. In the process of awakening to this unconscious witnessing, we come to perceive culture anew. A sensorial leap of this nature into the technological opens up possibilities for our consideration of cinema and spirituality in Islam. Referring to film technologies, Benjamin makes explicit that he sees these media as our collective senses. We see and hear through them together as one collective body. As mimetic technologies, they not only extend and therefore affect perception, but in doing so, they also retrain the sensorium to create the body in a new constitution. In the process of watching, the film viewer's senses are habituated to mechanized stimuli and recalibrated by them. For Benjamin, this recalibration is utopian, for in going through technology, the most intimately human aestheses can be politicized in collectively new ways. This capacity in film technology allowed Benjamin to imagine an alternative mode of aesthetics on par with modern collective experience, an aesthetic that could counteract at the level of sense perception the political consequences of the failed, that is, the capitalist, imperialist, destructive, and self-destructive reception of technology. Spirituality in cinema, as I've attempted to show, is not always or not necessarily a function of the story. It's not always or not necessarily seen on screen in the form of representations of prayerfulness or part of a plot engaged in the intricacies of a character's spiritual transformation. The spiritual impact of film on the viewer is rather embedded in the mimetic perception of aura in the sensory realm. In the moments of reflexivity and spatialization in the narrative continuity of film, the viewer becomes mindful of his or her own annihilation and reconstitution in the time that belongs to an atemporal cosmos, even as she encounters the metaphors of her own unconscious in the structures of intersubjectivity inhabiting a spiritual universe made conscious by the optics of film. This openness of the senses and of the soul to an entrainment by light through the mimetic technologies of film is doubtless at the center of a conscious spiritual practice in cinema. Thank you.